Okay, we are in verse 11 of chapter 27. Hey man, this is for you. You turned that into me yesterday. I appreciated the zeal. I was like, wow, he's memorizing other books. Okay, verse 11. We just got done kind of talking with the whole Judas thing, comparing Judas and Peter. And where Matthew kind of leaves each of them is a little bit unique compared to what we find in other Gospels. Moving on from that, though, we now are before Pilate. So verse 11. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" That is the question that we have been tracing throughout the book of Matthew, right? That is about as point blank as you can ask it. Are you the king of the Jews? Now notice something. Look at Matthew chapter 27, all of 27. There are only two places where you will see red letters. Two places. One of them is here. And the only other time will be when is one of the last several words that Jesus will say when he's hanging on a cross. And we'll hopefully get to that today. So this is really intriguing because Matthew has now all of a sudden gone from five major discourses where Jesus speaking the whole gospel to Jesus being silent. Therefore, the things that he does say should be emphasized as quite more significant because he is all of a sudden being very economic with the words that Jesus is saying. And Jesus looks at Pilate and says, "Yes, it is as you say." Now, why is that interesting or significant or intriguing? Ooh, I thought you were raising your hand, Jeremy. I got all excited. Why is that intriguing? Why is that exciting? What would stick out to me right here? Huh?
King.
Yet he is affirming to be king. What else?
It's as you say.
It is as you say. Maybe. But no, but you're along the same lines. Here's maybe let me get it a little bit more specific. Who is the you here? Isn't it interesting that the same question has already been asked to Jesus? Yeah? But he is not specific in his relaying of the information. He is, though, however, to Pilate. The clearest proclamation, the most blunt statement of his kingship is given to the Roman ruler. That's interesting. It's not that he hasn't been clear before now. It's just that the more that people reject listening to what he is saying, the purposefully more cloudy he becomes for them. Hence parables, the reason why they're told to people, because of the rebellion. Okay. "Yes," Jesus replied, "it is as you say." When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. See what Matthew's doing there. He is specifically bringing up the contrast. When they asked, he gave no answer. When Pilate asks, he does. Which you'd think would be the exact opposite if you're the Jewish king. The exact opposite. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they're bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply. Not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Here's what I think Jesus is continuing, what we've already been talking about. He refuses to play their political games. He's just not going to play the way that they play. He's not interested in it. He's not interested in their violent political program. He's not interested in fighting for his own honor. He's not interested in even fighting for his own prestige or even his own life. He's not interested in it. He refuses to fight the way they fight. He refuses to advance his kingdom the way they advance it. He's just not going to play their games. And this is going to be bringing out, great amazement to the governor. This is a little side note, but this is something really important for ministry. You will be, at some point in your ministry, falsely accused of something. You will be. And I'm not talking about sexual sins necessarily or anything like that. Because if you are there, then yeah, by all means, say, "Hey, I did not do that." But what I'll say is this. I've been accused of being a false teacher. I've been called a heretic. I've been told I'm leading people astray. I've been told that I'm basically a false prophet going straight to hell. And I'm not even like paraphrasing on a lot of those names. My dad was even, he had an elder accuse him of, whenever a woman was walking out of the church, she asked my dad if she could come and talk to him about salvation and being baptized. And the elder said that my dad told her he didn't have time. And that's just categorically not true. Absolutely false. If you knew my dad, if you knew his heart, he never would have said that. Of course, later the elder denied even ever saying that, even though he said it before everyone at a congregational meeting, which is all the more ironic. What do you do in those situations? You don't fight back. That's what you do. You let what you have done already in your ministry be the testimony to what you really would do or have been doing. Whenever you get falsely accused of being a heretic, you should say stuff like, "Everything I've spoken in public," and you didn't bring it up then. What does that sound like? Yeah. You fight back the way Jesus fought back. Too often people try to preserve their honor and power and end up splitting the church. And that's just not your job as a minister. You don't need to fight for your own honor. God, Jesus, He will take care of your honor. He will protect your integrity. Even if you have to go through a couple years of the mire and the muck, the truth will surface. You will be vindicated. Your job is not to win the approval or win the stamp of acceptance of other people. Your job is to be faithful to what you've been called to. And if you have done that, you have nothing to respond to. People will say, "Well, wait a minute, if they're saying false lies, stand up and fight for yourself." But is that what Jesus did? And His accusations are leading to His death. What are you fighting for in that position? Your own honor? Your honor means nothing. Because the bottom line is this. If you answer one false accusation, if they really want to take you down, they'll keep going until they finally get you. It's just the way it is. There's no, you don't need to fight for yourself. Fight for Jesus. Let Him fight for you. And guess what? He does fight. He does fight. So don't think that you're abandoning or being a coward. You're trusting that God will fight and vindicate you. You don't need to. All right. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. We really don't know a lot about Barabbas. We do know that his name literally means son of a father, which possibly could be intentional to disguise his true identity. That may not be his real name. Son of somebody. Well, that's convenient. We do know from Mark chapter 15 that he was arrested for something quite specific. It says a man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists, the political revolutionaries, who had committed murder in the uprising. This is a political revolutionary, Barabbas. That's all we really know about him. But we do know he was convicted or imprisoned for political uprising that also included murder. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" See, he's trying to make it very clear. He's saying, just six chapters earlier, y'all are calling this guy Christ. Surely you want him released, as opposed to Barabbas, who even though he was a notorious prisoner, he was a murderer and everyone knew it. And his revolution obviously had failed, otherwise he wouldn't be imprisoned. But this guy? You just called him your king. Because what Pilate is doing is this. Now this is, to me, is very interesting coming out of the Garden of Gethsemane. He sets him up and he says, "Which kingdom do you want? The violent one with Barabbas? Or the non-violent one with Jesus? Which one do you want?" And what do the people chant? What do they demand? Release Barabbas. Why? Because until now, the kingdom has been progressing violently through the hands of violent men who have laid hold of it. And that's the way they roll. Pilate says, "Which do you want? A guy that is clearly guilty or a guy that is clearly innocent?" They said, "We want this one because that's the way our kingdom works. Not like this idiot."
For he knew, verse 18, for he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him.
See, Pilate could see through the political game. He knew why Jesus was there. It wasn't for guilty of a crime. It was because these guys wanted his power. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message. Don't have anything to do with that innocent man. For I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. This is the second time within chapter 27 Jesus has been pronounced innocent using the same word. Who is the other one? Judas. Judas, yes?
I know that maybe not everybody's finished the book yet, mm-hmm. but in the book Matthew and Empire, he talks about how he thinks that Pilate knew that Jesus was guilty. Like, it was never a question of Jesus' guilt or not, but that the wife in her dream was saying, like, he's a religious man, not that he's an innocent man, because, like, he clearly claimed to be king of the Jews, which would have been treason.
Well,
I didn't feel like I agreed.
Right. See, and the reason why I had you guys read Carter is, number one, I do like the frame, the structure, the framework that he functions out of. I think it's that what you guys read in that book is what's cutting edge New Testament scholarship today. That's the kind of stuff that they're wrestling in. That's the kind of stuff actually that I'm doing my whole PhD on. That's the kind of stuff that he's wrestling in. Let me say this, though. Carter finds something under every rock. And that's what I also wanted you to see. You can't do. You can't do that. I mean, he finds something everywhere. And what were we just talking about here? You said, what did he say in particular?
That he was guilty.
That he was guilty. No, here, let me say this. Claiming king of the Jews is no different than what Herod was claiming. And Herod was the puppet of Rome. So it's not treason to claim that you're the king of the Jews. What is different is if you're claiming to have a whole separate kingdom. At that point, that's treason. But that's not what Pilate asks him. He doesn't say, do you have a separate kingdom from Rome? He says, are you king of the Jews? Herod claimed to be king of the Jews using the same terminology, and Rome was okay with that. So to sit there and say that he was committing treason by answering that doesn't match the way that Pilate reacts to him at all in Matthew or any of the other Gospels. Pilate was basically saying, so you're admitting that you should be the one ruling this group of psychos, which is the way Pilate treated them. You know, Pilate could have seen him as a potential threat to his own position because that's the position Pilate was in. But even still, Pilate could have just been thinking, okay, so that you'll be under my control then? Because you have to think the word king can be used fast and loose. It could refer to the emperor, but even Herod called himself king. So I totally disagree with that. Because it doesn't seem that's the way the trajectory is right here within Pilate. If that's the case, then Pilate wouldn't even have given them an option, expecting them to release Jesus. Wouldn't even have given them an option. He would have just said, yeah, you're going down. You know what? You and Barabbas both hop on up on the crosses. Now, I think we have political posturing here, but I have no way of establishing a motive that's not clearly stated. We do have political posturing. He is going to be quite strategic in the way in which he goes about this killing, because he is worried about rioting, because he's already been warned multiple times by Rome that if something happens again, he'll be removed like Herod Archelaus. So I agree with that there is political posturing. But I have no way of validating or invalidating a motive of somebody that's dead, and the only way he comes to me is through the text. I just have no way of saying yes or no to that. Anyway, good thought. Absolutely. All right, verse 20. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. The crowd is under the control of the powers of the Jewish elite. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor again. Barabbas, they answered. What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ? Notice he says it again. Pilate asked. They all answered, crucify him. What's his response? Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. They don't even give an answer. Because what answer is there to give? He said he was going to destroy the temple and build it back up in 3 days, even though that doesn't occur in Matthew. That's what they brought up inside of his trials. And Pilate would say, so? Who cares about your temple? They can't. They have no reason to crucify him, except the fact they just want him out of the picture. And Pilate sees that the reason why they want Jesus dead is not because he's guilty of a crime, because they're envious of his position. Why? What crime has he committed? They just shouted, crucify him. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, see what he has to avoid? He realizes at this point that releasing Jesus will start the riot. He can't release him and start the riot. In order to keep peace, one man must die. And in Pilate's eyes, that's okay. But that instead an uproar was starting. He took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. And oh my word, verse 25. All the people answered, let his blood be on us and on our children. That's bold. That is bold. Then he released Barabbas to them. But he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Now, I am very tempted at this point to go into details about the flogging. Very tempted. However, what we will notice in Matthew's gospel is that the details of Jesus' crucifixion, the actual crucifixion itself, is pretty much summed up in very small, minor, vague details. He's focused on something different, something bigger, mainly the events that are surrounding the crucifixion. And the reason why is because I believe that he structures all of the crucifixion around one key Old Testament passage. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but we'll trace the clues as we go through and they surface, and I will then reveal it to you once it's actually quoted. Does that make sense? But there are clues that all of the event is structured around an Old Testament passage. That's the clue, okay? You follow me? So I'm putting that out there now, knowing that it is vague and nebulous, but it will grow flesh here momentarily. Who in the world is texting me this morning? Okay, 7:19. That's all I needed to know. Okay. Where am I at? Texters getting in my head. Okay. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. Where is the praetorium? The specific building, we don't really know. We don't really know the specific building. What the praetorium was, though, in general, it was the living quarters of the ruler of that city. So this would have been Pilate's home. And we also have evidence that in some of the praetoriums, there would also exist the barracks of the soldiers. Sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. The soldiers' living quarters and, did I say Herod? I meant to say Pilate. And Pilate's living quarters, it's possible they could have been the same place. Question is, why'd they take him there? Because, like Vegas, what happens in the praetorium stays in the praetorium. That makes sense? They can do what they want to him. And it doesn't matter. The crowd can't see because they're not allowed in there. How did we get this information in the Gospel of Matthew? I don't know. Okay? Trying to answer all the questions that possibly be there. I have no idea. But we got it. So maybe there is a possibility. Maybe it's one of the centurions that was there that actually ends up converting. Because we do have that in Matthew. Relays the information to the disciples at some point. That's possible. Verse 28, they stripped him down and put a scarlet robe on him. What they're going to do is they're going to use three elements to mockingly mimic the ascension of an emperor. Three key elements that each symbolize something specific about an emperor. The first one is the scarlet robe, which the word for scarlet probably would be more purplish. The purplish tone, a deep red. That has kind of a purplish tint, which stands for royalty. So right off the bat, you have a man that is ascending to a point of royalty. And then they twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. The crown stood specifically in the Roman world for victory. Not just authority and rulership, although those are subsidiary. It was victory that the crowns wore. In a Roman triumphal procession, when they are marching through the city of Rome and celebrating the victory in battle, there would be multiple crowns that either would be hung on the chariot that the emperor is walking in, or there would be even a servant that the whole triumphal procession, the whole parade, he'd be holding the crown above the emperor's head as they went throughout the city. Why? Because the crown stood for victory, and multiple crowns stood for, victory over multiple entities, which Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 through 21, pictures Jesus coming on a white horse, and it says he's wearing multiple crowns, which is interesting to me. But that's another class. So they put a crown on his head, but it's of thorns, which is mocking the victory he claims to have. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. The staff would have been a reed or a rod, but it would have been intended to symbolize authority. Authority to rule. So what you have is this. You have royalty through the scarlet robe that is now claiming victory, the crown of thorns. And he is claiming to be ruling with his authority with the staff. And all of this is mocking the ascension of an emperor to their empire. Then they mock him and they yell out, "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. Which that sounds pretty interesting because that seems to be similar to what was being described both in Jesus' trial before Pilate and at the triumphal entry itself. Yes?
In Lucky Christ 4, Mark Moore said that, I think I remember him saying something about this being like, all the things they did would have been what they would exactly do in a coronation king, like when he's actually being like, king.
Yeah, they're mimicking the ascension of an emperor to his empire. Absolutely. Yeah, the coronation service, etc. Yeah, they're bringing in the key elements to mockingly show that he is who he claims to be. Yeah, absolutely. Verse 30, they spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. What do you notice there at the end? What's that? Yeah, why would they do something like that? Why would they do that? Huh? Maybe so that people would actually remember who it is that they've got. Possibly. Why else? Let me ask this question. Yeah, go ahead.
To symbolize that Rome is like the authority, that there's no other ruler over.
Yeah, there's definitely an exertion of power and authority here. Absolutely. Absolutely. What else?
They didn't want to get in trouble with
him. Ooh. From who?
From Pilate.
Maybe Pilate, but who else could get him in trouble?
People.
The Jews. Yeah? You see, what's shown here is that the kingdom of Rome is a lot like the kingdom of the Jews. Because what do they resort to? Violence. That's all they know how to resort to. And what do they try and do? Cover up their tracks so they can appear one way, but behind closed doors be a different way. Same thing that we've seen the Jews doing this whole time. Right? Even though Rome is mocking the Jews, mocking the Jewish kingdom by what they're doing to the Jewish king, they're also showing that we fight and we do the things pretty much the same way. We pretty much do the same way. The difference is, we've got the bigger stick. The only difference. And whoever has the biggest stick apparently gets to make the rules. Yeah, so they're trying to present the Jews and becoming riotous when they see the way in which they're mocking not just the person that claims to be the king, but even the Jewish kingdom itself. See what's happening? Okay, I thought I saw a hand. Verse 32, but it was just your hat. Anyway, as they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. This may be just coincidental irony, but I find it very interesting that the one Simon who should be next to Jesus helping him carry his cross, who committed to doing that, is nowhere to be found. And instead, there's a different Simon that's pulled out of the crowd to carry the cross. It could be coincidence, but that's very intriguing to me. Also, this says this. Whenever somebody is being carried with the cross, Rome can just pick anybody out of the crowd because, Justin, playing off what you were saying, Rome is not just communicating to the person being crucified, but everyone around that they are in control. And if they tell you, somebody that has nothing to do with the insurrection, to come carry a cross, guess what? You do it. Why? Because Rome is in charge. No one else, it is Rome. And what they say goes. Why? They have the biggest stick. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. What is the gall? We don't exactly know, but there's two potential options. Number one, it could be a type of mixture that was an antiseptic, which would numb Jesus or minimize the pain as a whole. The number two option is that it was possibly some sort of mixture of poison that would knock him unconscious, or that eventually, or would make him lethargic. It's kind of like if you're doing minor surgeries, they'll just give you a pill, a Valium pill, and you take that, and it just makes you kind of loopy to where when they're even cutting on you, it doesn't even hurt. You just kind of are there. That's possibly what this is. Jesus, though, now hear me very carefully. This is not, I'm not saying this as anti-medicine. Hear me very carefully, okay? I'm not saying you should never take medicine. Not saying that at all. I'm describing what Jesus is doing here, okay? Because people will take this and run this in all kinds of psychotic ways if you're not paying attention to context. Jesus chooses instead to drink the full cup of the suffering and in that rely completely on God. Okay? Fellowshipping in the sufferings of Jesus has nothing to do with you refusing to go to the doctor. Okay? A little different. I'd rather you be fellowshipping in the sufferings of you being persecuted because of the fact that you're speaking the true gospel. That's fellowshipping with the suffering of Jesus. When, verse 35, when they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. Very first clue for the Old Testament passage that is structuring this entire event. They cast lots for his clothes. Notice again, the key details that we're tracing here in Matthew are the things that are surrounding the crucifixion, not particularly the crucifixion itself. We don't have specific details of his flogging. We don't have specific details of his carrying the cross. It's all done in a sentence. It's all done in a sentence. But what we see is down below, they're casting lots for his clothing. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. The Jews would both accept and reject that particular title. Why would they accept it? Because it's his name. What else? Because the only reason why he's hanging on the cross is because of what is hanging over his head. Right? So they're okay with that. But why do they reject that? Yeah. It says that he is their king. And they're saying, no, he's not. No, he's not. We only have one king, and our king is Caesar. Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Help me exegete that verse. What's the first thing I run into that makes me go, huh, something bigger is happening here? First thing, robbers. What is that word? You can give me either the English translation of it that's more accurate or the Greek itself. Laestes? What? Insurrectionists. Political revolutionaries. This word is used four times in the Gospel of Matthew. Four times. First one, Jesus in the triumphal entry in Matthew chapter 21 comes and says, you have turned the house of God into a den of laestes. Into a den of political revolutionaries. First time. Second time, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus says, am I leading a laestes? Am I leading a rebellion, a political revolutionary that you need to come out with swords and clubs to come get me? Is that how my kingdom looks to you? The other two times is describing both of the robbers that are hanging next to Jesus. This is what I find very significant. This kind of brings in some atonement theology into the events here. Because more than likely, if Jesus wasn't hanging in between those two insurrectionists, Barabbas would have been. That is fascinating to me. That he literally took the place of someone else on the cross. It wasn't that they had to trump up and grab another cross because, hey, we got one more. No, the crosses were already there because they knew they were going to be, you know, killing three. And it's possible that Jesus literally took the place of Barabbas, a murderer. He literally took his place on the cross. Ooh, there's an application there, eh? I bet you Paul would have loved that story. Those who passed by hurled insult at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." What do you notice there? What does that sound like? Yes. Matthew chapter 4. If you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. If you are the Son of God, that is the chanting that Satan does consistently in the temptations itself. And right here at the foot of the cross, we once again see Satan is there. Satan is there. Hurling insults at him and saying, if you are the Son of God, come down. Save yourself. Use your power for yourself. Be selfish with your power. Be a different king in a different kingdom. Has nothing to do with the cross. You can do it, Jesus. Call down your angels. You know in a blink of an eye they'll come and wipe out everybody that's around. You know they will. Do it. You can have all the kingdoms of the world if you are the Son of God. See, Satan doesn't stop tempting Jesus after Matthew chapter 4. He appears lurking behind the scene with Peter at the Great Confession. And he appears in the Garden of Gethsemane. Three times, Jesus says, "Your will, but not mine." And he appears at the foot of the cross. Key junctures. Satan refuses to let Jesus' kingdom advance without him being there to try to influence it some other way. If you are the Son of God. This is also the second clue. The second clue of the particular text we're dealing with. Because the language, those who pass by and hurl insults, shaking their heads, is the exact parallel language that we find in the particular Old Testament text that I'm referring to and that I think is structuring this. Exact language in the Septuagint. But we'll get to that by and by. Verse 41, in the same way the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. Did you notice that? In the same way, which says, the Jewish elite are fighting for the kingdom of Satan. Because the same way the people at the foot of the cross, the same way that Satan tempted him, in the same way, so did the Jewish elite. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Which, that's interesting. I don't know if that would be exclamation point or question mark. Because remember, there's no punctuation in the Greek. He's the king of Israel? Oh, he's the king of Israel. You know, it depends on the voice inflection. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. What is ironic about that statement? Yeah, they want another sign. After he's done all these signs, they still say, we just want one more. But here's the incredibly ironic request here. If he comes down to the cross, they will believe in him. But the point in which he comes down from the cross is when he ceases to be the him that he's been trying to communicate to them. If Jesus comes off the cross, he is no longer the king he came claiming to be. And yet they say that's the one sign that if you do, we'll believe. Catch 22. Because Jesus could do that, cool sign, but then he's no longer the king in the kingdom. He's the king in the kingdom that Satan wanted him to be. Brilliant temptation there by Satan. Absolutely brilliant. Okay. Where am I? 43. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, I am the Son of God. This is the third clue. For that exact same language is found in the particular Old Testament text that I think is structuring this entire scene. Exact same language.
the same way, the robbers, the laestes, who were crucified with him, also heaped insults on him. So what you're seeing here is absolute abandonment. The disciples, nowhere to be found. Rome, well, not going to help out this idiot. All the Jewish elite, gone. The crowds, abandoned. Now even the people being crucified with him are mocking him. He is completely surrounded by evil. Evil that is laughing at him and making fun of him. And this is what follows this particular picture. Notice what is being painted more than anything in Matthew is what is happening around Jesus. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. That should not surprise us. This is the first out of four particular signs that we are going to see over the next, well, until the end of, the end of chapter 7. One of four signs. This sign should not surprise us because Matthew chapter 24, verses 29 through 31 shows us, as well as all the prophetic literature, even in the book of Revelation, that anytime there is a political upheaval, it is literally and figuratively. Not literally and figuratively. Figuratively, or in this case, literally, usually connected with the effects of celestial powers. Because remember, Matthew chapter 24, when he's talking about the destruction of the temple, he says, and the sun will be darkened, and the moon will be turned to blood red. Right? Acts chapter 2, whenever Peter's speaking from the prophet of Joel, one of the things he brings up is the sun being darkened and the moon being turned to blood red. Revelation brings up the sun being darkened. What is it saying? Whenever there is a political upheaval, a shift of kingdoms, it is kind of like a new creation. Whenever everything is dark and void, and yet from it emerges the light of a new dawn. It's very appropriate for there to be blackness that fills the land at the time of the crucifixion. Because there's going to be a political upheaval through this action when a new kingdom is established, a new king is sitting on the throne, and that is about as close as you can get to a new creation outside of the actual new creation that is to come. Okay, we'll come back to that. Because here comes the thing I've been teasing you with for pretty much the whole class. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? People will say, that in this moment, God abandoned Jesus. That he left him. Because he had to. Because Jesus in this moment took all the sins of the world on him, and God can't be around sin. Let me just say that really quick. That's just not true. God can be around sin. If you don't believe me, read Job. Who walks into the courtroom of God? Satan! Right? It's not like, you know, sin is God's kryptonite and he has to keep it away from him at all moments. We treat him like that from Greek philosophy, not from biblical theology. Does that make sense? We treat him like that. However, that's not what we find here. I am going to suggest, because of the particular Old Testament passage, I think is structuring this entire scene, that Jesus is saying the exact opposite. That even though it looks like absolute abandonment is happening, God never left him. And that's how he attains victory. Turn to Psalm 22. Because that's what Jesus quotes here. This is a Psalm of David. Coincidence? I don't think so. Psalm 22. I'm going to read a lot of this, so be there with me. Starts off, my God, why have you forsaken me? Eh? Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Why are you so far from saving me? So far from the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, and am not silent. What is this describing? What is this describing? Absolute abandonment. Verse 3. And yet, you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the praise of Israel. In you, our fathers put their trust. They trusted, and you delivered them. It says, even though it looks like you are absolutely abandoned me, I know that you haven't. That's what David says. Because you're always enthroned. And every time we've trusted in you, you've delivered. No matter, even when it looks like the world is crumbling down, you have never left us. Verse 4 starts over the whole process. Verse 6. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by men and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. The exact same language that we find in chapter 27, we also find here. They mock, hurl insults at the bottom of the cross, and they shake their heads at him. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. What does it sound like?
Trust in God.
Yeah, he trusts in God. Let God pull him down from the cross. Come, if you are the Son of God, that's what you claimed, right? Let him deliver you. Verse 9, and yet, you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you even from my mother's breast. From birth I was cast upon you, from my mother's womb. You have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near, and there is no one to help. Now let's skip down to verse 15, because this is where it starts to sound even more familiar. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. Hello? Where are we? I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Have we heard this? But you, O Lord, be not far off. O, my strength, come quickly to help me. Deliver my life from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen. I can almost hear David saying, also from the red dragon. I will declare your name to my brothers. In the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. That's weird. The one at the very beginning who was saying, he's abandoned me, is now commanding the people to praise him. You who fear the Lord, praise him, all you descendants of Jacob. Honor him, revere him, all you descendants of Israel. Listen to verse 24. For he has not despised or disdained the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. Listen to the way this ends. Verse 27. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. In a time of abandonment, when it looks like the whole world is crashing down, like the kings of the world have conquered God, have conquered David, David says God is in control and he will rule the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him. Those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn. Listen to the last line. For he has done it. More than Jesus saying, God has abandoned me, he is singing his favorite hymn. It's probably the same song that Jesus was humming with his dad when he's working in the carpentry shop. It's probably the same song that Jesus was singing with his disciples on the road in their ministry. It's probably the same psalm that he was humming in the Garden of Gethsemane. And now at the cross, Jesus is singing the same song. And what the song says is this. Even whenever the world looks like it has taken over, like it is the end-all be-all, like God has abandoned me, I will trust the Lord because he will never abandon me. And it is through this suffering that he finds victory. For he has done it. See, Jesus starts singing the first line because he knows how the last line finishes. He's not saying God abandoned me. He's saying, let's sing a song. Let's sing a song. A song about victory in the midst of suffering, because you guys think that victory only comes through the sword. But let me tell you, you don't call the shots. For the victory is bigger than even what you can develop, even bigger than a cross. They have pierced my hands and my feet. Yeah, they may have. They're hurling insults. They're casting lots for my clothing. Yeah, they may do that. It looks like God has absolutely abandoned me. It does look like that. And yet, He's there. He never leaves. Question?
I just had a question as to if it's also supposed to direct and point towards the line of David,
Absolutely. I mean, this is a psalm about the establishment of the kingdom. About the future hope that David is singing about in the kingdom that is established through suffering. Absolutely. That's why to me, this quoting of this psalm blows my mind. Because it's grabbing everything that Matthew has been developing about his kingdom into one song, and Jesus starts humming it as he's dying on the cross. Because he's saying, you've never seen the world through my kingdom lens. And if you did, if you saw it through my lens, through the lens of David, you would see that this is going to bring my victory, not my defeat. Because this is how he has done it. It's through my sacrifice. Absolutely. Because that's the way the psalm ends, the establishment of a kingdom forever. Verse 47, when some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Why? Because Eloi, Eloi, whenever you are absolutely in pain and suffering, may sound like Eli, Eli. Elijah. We add the ja because it's easier for us to say in English. But that's not what he's been saying in Aramaic. Again, though, they misinterpret it. They miss it. Oh, he's calling for Elijah. No, Elijah's already come. You missed him. That's the point. You missed him. You're still looking for something that's not there. Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. You've missed it. I will say this. Every single time that Elijah or John the Baptist surfaces after chapter 11, it is always in the context of violence and nonviolence. Always. Very intriguing to me. Verse 50, and when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. You see, the details of the crucifixion in Matthew are much different than the rest of them. The rest of them, we have, you know, the specific words of Jesus, into your hands I commit my spirit. We don't have a lot of that in Matthew because he's trying to structure it around Psalm 22, which is focused on the events surrounding the cross and the victory that it brings through suffering. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. That's the second sign. And we'll start with that one tomorrow. Verse 51. I love you guys.